Well, we are back in our study of the offerings of Israel, and the last time that we met, I kind of did more of a survey or overview of the significance of the offerings. I felt like I needed to do that, and so we understand that they were not for salvation, but that they actually are for a maintenance of a relationship that's already going on. I think we've covered the burnt offering fairly well. I think we understand what happened with that offering or how it works. And to keep in mind that its primary purpose was to devote your entire self, your whole life, all of yourself to the Lord. That's why it is burnt up. Sin is not the primary issue. Certainly, anytime there's an offering, we are sinners. We need atonement, but in this particular case, the atonement is not for sin, as it says in the sin and the guilt offering. It's atonement for the worshiper, the one who is worshiping, which means it's a complete offering of yourself. And of course, being an unblemished animal, all of that animal is burnt up before the Lord, and then it becomes a sweet aroma to the Lord. Today, I want to go into the New Testament to see what parallels we might have. That's kind of the purpose of the study, is not just to look at the offerings of Israel, but also to see how they connect to the New Testament. This is the one that I am fairly confident with. Some of the other offerings, I'm going to have to dig into the principles of the offering a little bit more and then to find just the right passages in the New Testament. But this one I have already hinted at. In fact, before I even started the study, I knew this would be the connection. However, I found another passage in my studies, and just about a week ago, I discovered a connection to another text, and actually another book in the New Testament that connects with it that I was not anticipating. It was through some word studies and other things. So really my purpose today is to go through both passages, but the one primary one is going to be Romans 12. Now, I know that Ron is working through Romans, so I am not anticipating stealing any of his thunder at all. In fact, I am not going to do a study of Romans with you right now, but I am going to look at these first two verses of Romans 12. Many of you know these verses. I remember, I think, in Bible memory programs, these two verses often show up. And so I want to work through these, but also to say that it's my opinion that the burnt offering most closely connects with this statement because it is talking about a complete devotion, a complete giving of yourself, your life, and who you are and what you do to the Lord. So let me go ahead and read it in the ESV, and then as I've done in the past, and you'll have to forgive me on this, but I'll pick apart a few elements of the translation. I do that occasionally, but I will give validation for what I'm doing. Some of you know this in the King James, because when I memorized it, I remember doing that. But let me go ahead and read it to you in the ESV, these first two verses. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Now, there's an awful lot that's packed into these two verses, but looking at the overview of the book of Romans, I think you're earlier in Romans right now, I believe. I don't think you've made it quite this far. Okay, 8. Well, then you're at the threshold of the end of his discussion on salvation, the process of salvation, justification, sanctification, glorification. Those are the big words, of course, but you're going to get into 9 through 11, which is going to be a somewhat of a diversion. I don't want to think of it as a parenthesis, but it's really a discussion on what about Israel is kind of what starts it. And the end of chapter 11 is profound. In my opinion, it gets to a point where Paul is discussing the issue and then is overwhelmed by God's plan and program and how he is working everything together. That in the church, we now have all of these fulfillments that we would never have anticipated. Just reading your Old Testament, you would not have seen it this way. And that seems to be the way that God works. He works in such a way where no one else can take the credit. When you look past all of the coincidences, ironies, and other things that are going on, ultimately you get to a point where you realize this is not coincidental. God is the one at work. And so he has this statement at the end of 11, "Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways." And this is, by the way, a former Pharisee speaking. We have to remind ourselves of that, someone who's been trained and studied the scriptures. And quite often when Jesus encountered the religious leaders, they were rather arrogant. Paul is showing a humility of realizing that God's ways are not ours, that his thoughts are above ours. And so this passage fits perfectly into that transition because as some divide the book, and they divide Paul's writings quite often this way, is there's the theological section and the practical section. Now for outlining, that's a nice way to divide his books. However, I want you to know with Paul, those two things are not disjointed from one another. Theology is always a part of practice. Practice is always connected to our theology. In fact, really, thinking rightly will allow you to live rightly as well in terms of the way that you apply your faith and apply your understanding. So this is a passage I think is profound. In fact, I could actually, after talking about it, thinking about it, I could back up to the, "Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God," because I believe this passage speaks to both groups, which Paul often does, to both Jewish Christians who have all of the background of the temple, the sacrificial system, all that we've been studying, but it also is a statement for the Greeks as well and for the Gentiles, the pagan worship. This is an amazing thing to bring both of those together because they're coming from two completely different worlds. Think about this, that in the first century you had Jewish Christians worshiping alongside Gentile Christians. And we know there's tension, we see that in the New Testament, but just coming from the different mindsets and how they are thinking about their, in the pagan way, their gods and how you worship them versus the Jewish way, which is going to come from the Old Testament. This passage brings both together and shows that neither of those systems, the Jewish system, the Old Covenant, and the Greek system are adequate to cover what really needs to take place in worship. Christian worship means that we are part of a new covenant where the Holy Spirit dwells within us, which means we are temples. It's like having a movable temple, a movable tabernacle again, but now the temple is in our lives. We are the temple of God. And what that means is our worship is not focused in just locations. Like we will go into a sanctuary and we will worship. And that is an important part of our community faith. But as I go about my life, my worship experience, I'm taking with me. I'm taking the presence of God with me. And that means that my worship is everything that I do, my whole behavior. All throughout the week, what we do is reflective of the way that we are worshiping the Lord and the way that we are communing with Him. This is so radically different from the way Jewish Christians would have thought. Well, as Christians, they should be changing their thinking, but Jews coming in thinking that we go to the temple, that's where we do the sacrifice. And Greeks and Romans worshiping in their temples, but in a completely different way, but still worshiping. Now, worship is something that is a part of all of our lives. In fact, it's part of what we would call the Christian ethic, because the way that we behave is part of our worship. All right, I've summarized kind of my thoughts, but let's get into the details just a little bit. As I said, with a burnt offering, since the whole offering is burnt up, all of it goes to the Lord. This, I think, connects most closely to that because Paul is saying that we are to be a living sacrifice. That is, you're not the typical sacrifice. Here's the problem with the sacrificial system, and that is it's inadequate to really demonstrate what it should in terms of our relationship to the Lord. Let's go back to our Jewish system a minute, our Old Testament, Old Covenant system. When you bring the animal before the Lord, you place your hand on the animal, and what that does is identify that animal now with you. That's symbolic. That is obviously not real. It's symbolic. And so the symbolism is that as this animal is now sacrificed before the Lord, and all of it is burned up before the Lord, all of myself, all of who I am, that is now the Lord's. That's the devotion side of it. The only problem is that's an inadequate way of doing it because it's symbolic. And there's a problem with symbolism. I love symbolism. I think it's a part of worship and a part of Christianity. But there can be a problem with symbolism, and that is that we focus so much on the symbol that we miss the meaning itself behind it. Ideally, the way that an Israelite worshiper should be approaching the Lord is once they give that offering and that's burning up and they see the smoke going up, they should be thinking, that's me. I am the one that is being offered to the Lord. The problem is that in our depraved state, our weakened state, we will look at the symbol and think, oh, that has taken care of the situation. I now have, I said I'm devoted to the Lord, but now I go and I live whatever way that I want to until the next time. If I feel guilty or if I feel like I need to do it again, I'll bring another animal. But the problem is there's a disconnect between the symbol and the reality. And this is one of the challenges whenever we have symbolic things in the church, in communion. This is why in the Reformed tradition, you never do the sacrament without the word to go with it to explain what's going on. Well, with Israel, it was clear when you get to the prophets, they were offering sacrifices, but yet they were hypocritical in their lives. And they were mistreating one another. Isaiah chapter 1, it says, you're approaching me and you have blood on your hands because you're essentially harming others while you're saying that you're devoted to me. So this is the solution to the problem, is that how about that we could be purified in such a way that we could approach a holy God without the intermediation, the intermediate step of having an animal being sacrificed? What if we could be cleansed in such a way where we would be the unblemished one coming before the Lord, and now we are not, there's not a blood sacrifice demanded of us because one has already taken place that is good for all time? The blood sacrifice has taken place. I am now purified before the Lord, and that means I can be a living sacrifice, which is an oxymoron. That whole terminology would be an oxymoron. It would not fit with the way people would think. Because even in pagan worship, they were sacrificing animals. How can you be a living sacrifice? Well, the only way that's possible is if God has done a work in us to such a degree that we can be seen by God as pure and as unblemished. And that can only happen through the blood of Christ. Now, everything up to this point in Romans has pretty much told you that, at least through chapter 8, where you're going, where you are right now. But this is what is holy and acceptable to God according to this. This is how we now are in the new covenant. That's why we don't, if anyone ever asks you, well, why don't you have sacrifices as Christians if you follow the Old Testament? Well, the issue is we follow the Old Testament, but we realize the Old Testament has a built-in expiration date on the Old Covenant. I've told you that before, all right? That's my terminology for it. It's a built-in expiration date, and even in the Old Testament, it's anticipating a new covenant. This is now the new covenant that we have. So the living sacrifice is that we can now be wholly devoted to the Lord in our behavior and in our lives, and it is not necessary to have the burnt offering anymore. Now, here's where I'm going to have a little bit of a criticism, and I've done some research on this and some study. The word spiritual worship at the end, some of you might remember this from King James, it's reasonable worship. You recall that? Some of you have memorized it. It's your reasonable, actually it's not reasonable worship, it's reasonable service. That's right, reasonable service. And the word service, both in Greek and in Hebrew, can imply worship. That part I'm not as concerned about. It's the word spiritual. And yes, I'm criticizing the word spiritual. The Greek word is logikane, and L-O-G-I-K, or L-O-G-I-C, you could say as well. The word logical is derived from it. And I did some study of ancient Greek, Liddell Scott, actually. It goes beyond just the biblical Greek, but also to classical and other uses. And it seems that the translation of reasonable is reasonable. It makes sense that it's talking about what is intelligent, what is reasonable, what is essentially not mindless worship, but very much worship that you are thinking about. Mindless worship is something we can even fall into as well. And I'm still not certain of why spiritual has come into this translation. This is not the only one that has done this. Every commentator that I looked at, even the more modern ones, will say, well, other translations say spiritual, but this is really the meaning. And so I'm not sure what provoked the spiritual, because to me that sounds like it's spiritual as opposed to physical or something like that. Maybe it's spirit-directed, Holy Spirit. But the thing is, it seems that it's talking about what is intelligent worship. Now, I know not too many people look at this translation anymore because it's old and people generally don't look at older things, I guess, but J.B. Phillips' New Testament, I've always heard on the next verse people quoting that, but I never looked at the previous verse. He actually says intelligent worship. Now, I'm sure that people hearing that would say, what does that mean? But what it seems to be is that it's talking about people who are very purposeful in their worship. They know what they're doing. They know why they're doing it. And what's important about that is, let's take these two worlds. In Jewish worship, the symbolism is the problem. There's a symbolic giving of yourself, but there's not this devotion to obeying God's commands. Now, you can look in the Old Testament. It's clear. God wants you to obey His commands. It's part of your covenant relationship with Him. But it's not generally connected to worship. Like you actually give your worship, you devote yourself to the Lord, but then your obedience is something separated from it. What this is going to talk about is that your mind is being transformed in such a way that your behavior is following that. That you actually obey the Lord, that you actually follow His commands. In other words, your ethic connects with your worship. What you do is your worship, really. Your behavior is your worship. So that's the transformative side, I guess, of ancient Jewish worship to what we have in the New Testament. So what that means is Paul is challenging those who are Jewish to hear this and to say, there is no longer this sacrificial system. You are the sacrifice. You are the living sacrifice. And let me go on, and then I'll come back to the Greeks in a minute. do not be conformed to this world. This is where everyone translates Phillips, because the word conform there only appears twice. This is how I wound up with my other passage, by the way. It only appears twice in the New Testament. It has the sense of being put into some kind of a form or a mold. In fact, in non-biblical Greek, it's usually some sort of artisan or craftsman who presses something into a mold to shape it so that it can be a certain shape, and then it becomes either a work of art or just something that you're using. So J.B. Phillips was very creative with this. He said, do not let the world around you squeeze you into its mold. And I know for people who are very bent on literal translations, well, that's not word for word. I'm not going to get into the discussion of that, although I have a bunch of Wycliffe people here who would agree with me on this, but we will not get into the discussion. Word for word is not the best way to translate from one language to another. If I were in, I go to Africa and I have translators, if I just gave them individual words, they would look at me and say, I can't do anything with that. Like, just say this after me. Remember, you, should, not. That does not work. You can't do that in another language. Give me a whole thought, then translate it. Okay, well, I won't get on that hobby horse, but Phillips is doing a good job in getting the thought out there, which is that, and the thing is, world there is not just the immediate world around us. It's really the whole world system and even the world view that is around us. Don't let that squeeze you into its mold. Don't let it conform you to what it is saying. Instead, be transformed by the renewal of your mind. I think the mind there is connected to that reasonable worship, because it's from the mind that we have to begin in our process of our behavior. You don't just automatically, in fact, none of us can automatically do the right thing. When somebody tells you, well, do the right thing, usually that requires that you have to know something about the right thing and that you understand what you're doing to understand the right thing. So it's not mindless. It doesn't just happen automatically, because that's not who we are. So the renewal of our mind, and of course, Paul has a lot to say about mind. When we were in Philippians, let this mind be in you that was also in Christ Jesus. And then, of course, that's the humility side of things. But the transformation of the mind, we have to think differently to act differently. And so that is what is being dealt with here. Don't let the world push you into its mold. You have to think differently, which is going to create a problem, because if your worldview doesn't match the worldview of those around you, it is possible persecution can come from that, which is exactly what the first century Christians dealt with on both sides, not just from Jews, but also from the Gentile world as well, because they don't fit into that mold. Well, in the Greek world, what does worship look like? Well, now I'm not going to go into a lot of the details, but I will say this, because I don't want to go into some of the details, that Gentile worship, pagan worship, matches the behavior of their gods and goddesses. And if you know anything about Greek mythology, you'll know morality is not a major issue with them. How many kids did Zeus actually have? How did he seduce women? You know, if the whole idea is when you're worshiping a god or a goddess to match their behavior, the behavior is repulsive. It's horrible from our perspective, because it's just very immoral, unethical, it's very selfish. And so their worship system often involved prostitutes, temple prostitutes. And so for them, there are two ways that they could handle this. One is, if you're an Epicurean, coming from that standpoint, pleasure is the goal of all of life. And so worshiping is finding your goal, finding that. So the physical pleasure that's connected with that action is now connected to your higher purpose, and also connected to all the gods and goddesses' behavior. I just want to pause a moment on that, because think about where the Jews are coming from with their worship system, that God said, you are not to do that. Okay, you're not to have any part of that. With the Canaanites, that was part of their worship. With other pagan groups from before the Greeks, they were doing those sorts of things. And God makes it very clear, that is not how you worship me. I have a place, a very specific place, and a very specific way in which that is fulfilled, but that is not part of the worship that you bring to me. So the pagans are coming from that angle, and they're trying to figure out, okay, how is it that my body and my mind are two separate things? In Greek thinking, that's quite common. And so whatever I'm doing with my body doesn't necessarily have to have anything to do with my mind. So my behavior, what that leads to is my behavior can be radically different from my spiritual experience. The other side would be not just Epicurean, that's the one side where pleasure is kind of highlighted. The Stoic side is the opposite. Ignore pain, ignore pleasure, so that you can have the spiritual experience. Some of the Eastern religions today have this in their connection. Hinduism, Buddhism, they will do this. So the mind and the body are separated. Now, so what we have are these two groups coming together within the church. And these are two completely different worldviews and two completely different ways of thinking of worship. My worship as a Jew would have been the symbolic sacrificial system. My worship as a pagan obviously needs to be changed because, well, we don't have temple prostitutes. We don't have all of the things that I'm used to in that worship. And also, now I'm being told that my mind and my body are not all that distinct, that my mind transforms me in such a way where now what I do is connected to it. So here you're trying to bring these two groups together. Well, in my opinion, this passage is amazing in that it will bring the two groups together. But they're going to be hearing it differently. When you hear living sacrifice from your Jewish background, you're thinking, oh, no longer dead sacrifice. But then when you're hearing these other words, the first of all, thoughtful or intelligent worship, as well as not being conformed and being transformed, as a Gentile, you're thinking, oh, this is radically different from what I know. So regardless of what your background is, the point is that the offering to God is now something that involves your whole self, mind and body, which means when you're obeying Him, that is part of your worship experience. Obedience to Him is your worship. I know for us, we have to almost remind ourselves that when I am doing the right thing, when I am following God's commands, that is connected to my worship. That's not just connected to, oh yes, I need to do this or He will get me or something like that. We are not driven by fear. So my worship is not just what I'm doing here in this building. My worship extends to my entire life. And so Paul starts his, if you want to call it the practical section, with that thought. And that's profound because now everything that he says in the rest of the letter is going to flow from that idea. That it is the sacrifice that you had as Jews with the burnt offering, this is now you in your life. And for those of you who are Gentile and Greek, wouldn't even have any connection to that other sacrificial system, your worship involves your mind and your body together. Your whole self is involved in that. So the way you treat others, the way you behave, the faithfulness you have in your relationships is all connected to your worship of the Lord. So that, I think, is what has happened. Now, I told you that I went on a trail, this was last week, to 1 Peter because I discovered, looking at this word conformed, that it also appears in 1 Peter. And all I was expecting was I was just looking at 1 Peter chapter 1. It's actually in verse 14. But I was looking at this verse and thinking, all right, this just helps me understand the word conformed. But then I realized, lo and behold, Peter and Paul are probably saying the exact same thing, just in different ways, about the whole worship experience. So in 1 Peter, I don't know how far back to go. I don't want to go back too far. Let's go to 13. Please hear Peter on this too, because here's another case where some people will try to, link certain letters with only certain audiences. And it seems to me it's a rare occasion. Book of Hebrews, Philippians, maybe. But it's a rare occasion when you're only dealing with just Jews or just Greeks, because the church is a mixture. And the point is, all of the apostles are trying to pull them together and not have them separated. So I believe that Peter is speaking to both groups as well, even though he definitely has a Jewish connection. And he speaks of exiles at the very beginning. So a lot of people think, the exiles are strictly exiles of the Jews. I don't think that's what he means by that. I think that he's speaking of exiles in the sense of you are an exile in this world. You are actually in exile because you are not part of this world. The same idea as you're not part of, the world system. So come down to 13 a minute and we'll see he's really doing the exact same thing. In fact, I think 14 fits with the Gentile context as much as the Jewish one. Therefore, preparing your minds for action, just that alone, right there. Stop right there. Your minds for action. That means your mind, your body, they are connected. What you think and what you do are connected. And being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Now, one thing in this book that we can say, whether it's Jew or Gentile, is there is persecution going on. The focus of this book is really on the suffering that's going on and how to view that suffering in light of what God is doing. But now look at verse 14. As obedient children, do not be conformed. Same exact word. The only other time it appears in the New Testament. Same word as Paul uses in Romans 12:2. Do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, since it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. You want to know where that quote is from? Which book of the Old Testament do you have, be holy as I am holy? Leviticus, the one we are studying. All right? Your Jewish connection or your Old Testament connection is right there. But did you hear the words in verse 14? Do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance. That word passions there can also be lusts or desires. Now, that works for Jews as well as Gentiles, but for Gentiles, they're going to hear that in a different way. I mean, they're being taught from the time they're quite young that what you do in your mind and what you do in your body are two completely different things. I can do all kinds of things with my body as long as my mind is pure in its thinking of certain things, it's fine. I mean, they have this division, and it's not just Plato. It's throughout all of their writings and their thinking. So here it is saying, don't be conformed to your lusts and your desires. Remember in the Romans, it was don't let the world around you squeeze you into its mold. Well, who's squeezing or what is squeezing us into a mold here? Our desires, our passions, our lust. Don't let your desires conform you. Okay? Don't let that shape you and who you are and what you do. Instead, And it says your former ignorance, which to me, that whole phrase in verse 14 to me sounds like it's definitely directed to a Gentile audience especially. But it works in the Jewish context because here we have verse 15, as he who called you is holy, you also be holy, but not just in some general way. Be holy as I am holy. He's saying in your conduct, in the way you behave. So that let's say you're a Jewish Christian. Again, this is doing the same thing that Paul's doing. You're no longer bringing your sacrifice. You're no longer bringing a burnt offering and saying, this animal now represents me, and now it's all burned up to the Lord, and therefore that's devoting me to the Lord. Okay, I don't have that anymore. So what's the substitute? The substitute is I am the sacrifice. I am the one that is wholly devoted to the Lord. It's not just a symbol, it's me. I am the one. Because Christ has brought me into the presence of God Himself. In fact, the presence of God is now in me in such a way that I am the sacrifice. And I am the one that in my behavior, I am worshiping the Lord. It's my intelligent worship. It's my reasonable worship, my sensible worship. This is the way that we do it. And then, of course, with the being holy as I am holy, you know what? I have a whole discussion and lesson on Leviticus 19 where that's found. Because when I first encountered Leviticus 19, I was all New Testament for a while till I jumped over and I guess betrayed New Testament. I don't know. I had my New Testament prof say, why did you do that? Well, I did it because I was trying to figure out my New Testament to go. So I went to my old Leviticus 19. I never could figure out why it says that other major command, love your neighbor as yourself, is in verse 18 of chapter 19 of Leviticus. I never could figure out why that's placed there because it's right around a whole bunch of laws. You got all these laws, and then all of a sudden you have love your neighbor as yourself, and it sounds like it's just another law. Until you go back to verse 2 of chapter 19, and it says, be holy as I am holy. And so I'm wondering, okay, what's the connection between holiness and love your neighbor? And when you look at all of the laws that are surrounding love your neighbor, you realize it is your conduct before other people. And how you're living out your love in other people. Really, the whole chapter is about that. It's not just that one verse. Because I always thought it was somewhat misplaced. The first command, love the Lord your God, you can find that in Deuteronomy 6 very clearly. 6:5 has that, and you can see, hear Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. That's in a very obvious place. Not the love your neighbor, though. Now, what's on the outside is amazing, too, although I would never present this. I've never preached this, nor would I probably. Leviticus 18 on one side and 20 on the other is all of the pagan practices of how they relate to one another. And it's all of the sexual sins, but it also includes sacrificing your children to Molech. So it has all of these pagan practices that are surrounding chapter 19. But in 19, it starts with be holy as I am holy, which is another way of saying be unique in the same way that I, as your God, am unique. And unique to what? Unique to all of the other gods. Well, all of the other gods behave immorally, selfishly. There is no genuine love there. They do not know sacrificial love at all. And so be the same as me means love your neighbor. Love, in our context, love one another. And by loving one another, you are not the same as those surrounding you. I think it's actually, now I'm amazed at Leviticus in that part because it's a brilliant strategy to put on the outside of that passage, on both sides, the pagan practices. And then to say right in the center is the command. And again, in Jewish thinking, well, Hebrew thinking, they have this structure where the things on the outside match and the thing in the middle is unique, different? Well, the unique thing is love your neighbor. Don't operate like this, but operate like that. If I had time, we'd dive into that, and I'd just say Paul and Peter doing the exact same thing, just with different words. Fewer words, really. Okay, well, I hope I wasn't rambling too much. I tend to go off sometimes. The main issue is the burnt offering that we have in the Old Testament, I believe, is the living sacrifice in the New, which means the way that we behave throughout the week in every context that we are in is part of our worship for the Lord. It is our worship. And I know, I love the worship here. I love, and I, you know, going to be in the choir here this next hour, and I love just being in that place and having that worship that we have, lifting our hearts to the Lord. But that is not just a one-time, one-space thing. That's to be part of our lives. And we do that in our conduct and in our behavior. Remember, you're a temple. And God's presence is with you. And that means He empowers you to do the supernatural, to do the things that you could not do on your own. All right, I have a few moments, I guess, although someone, no, I guess that's right. No, somebody hasn't changed the clock. I was going to say, I'm really late for worship if it's 11:22 right now. Anyone or comments, if anyone has any?